ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, I have a fantastic show lined up this week. I think all of you ETF gurus in particular are really going to enjoy this one. Joining me will be Ajalin Loader, who's a contributor to ETF.com. She previously worked with the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg. She's a freelance writer. So there was some news last week that the popular cybersecurity ETF, the ETFMG Prime Cybersecurity ETF ticker HACK, along with the ETFMG Prime Mobile Payments ETF, ticker iPay, which together these have over $2 billion in assets. But there was news that these ETFs will be reorganized under Exchange Traded Concepts, who's another ETF firm. And that's generated some questions around exactly how this process will take place and whether there might be any investor impact here. There are also some questions around ETFMG itself, who currently offers 14 ETFs, about $3.5 billion in assets. So given the popularity of these ETFs and some of the questions I was hearing, I thought it'd be helpful to just walk through what's happening here. And I've got to tell you, Ajalin has been all over this story from the very beginning. Probably nobody better to discuss this, so she'll join me momentarily. I'll also be joined this week by Dave Nodig, Chief Investment Officer and Director of Research at ETF Trends and ETF Database. Dave needs no introduction, one of the top minds in the ETF space. And we're just going to spitball on a bunch of different topics, including the Fed's bond ETF purchases, Robinhood traders, and Dave Portnoy, active ETFs, DFA, and a whole lot more. So that should be fun. And then I'll close this week with Will Hershey, co-founder and CEO of Roundhill Investments, who recently launched a sports betting and iGaming ETF that's had a tremendous start in terms of attracting investor interest. So I'll have Will spotlight that ETF. And we'll also touch on a video game and esports ETF they offer. That segment of the market has done really well this year, one of the best performing areas. So we'll touch on that as well. As always, questions or comments, you can find me out on Twitter at Nate Geraci, or you can go to ETFprime.com. Let's start with ETF.com contributor, Ajalin Loader.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
Ajalin, a pleasure connecting. Appreciate you taking the time this week.
Thanks for having me on.
And just to be clear, so you're a contributor to ETF.com, but you're a freelance writer, right? You contribute to several different media outlets. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct. I used to work for the Wall Street Journal and before that for Bloomberg News.
Okay, so you've been following this saga with ETFMG since the very beginning. As I understand it, you actually sat in the courtroom at times, right? You listen in on the litigation?
I did. And if anyone has any trouble sleeping, I would recommend doing that.
Well, just to set the table before we talk about this news from last week, do you want to explain what happened here originally, what the original dispute was?
Sure. And to do that, I'll go back to the start of HACK, which was launched in 2012. Now, this was kind of a joint venture with a firm. It was the International Securities Exchange, or ISE. And they basically had an ETF incubator that helped people, like small would-be ETF entrepreneurs, bring their funds to market. So what ISE did is ISE provided the funding to operate HAC with a firm called PureShares, and it was traded under the Pure Funds brand name. And that basically provided the funding to operate it, which in return for a lion's share of any of the profits. And I don't mean the profits from the investments. I mean the profits from the management fees of the fund. Now, that's a risky proposition because most new funds flopped. And at the time, no niche ETF like HAC had ever taken off. And then the massive cyber breach at Sony happened a few weeks after HAC's launch, and HAC raised a tremendous amount of money and was a huge success. So it was extremely profitable. The fees came to something at certain points as much as $600,000 a month. And there were a number of other funds also launched with this kind of joint venture arrangement. Now, to launch this, ISE and Pure Funds brought in a firm to act as the investment advisor in the trust. It was a white label or private label ETF firm called ETF Managers Group, or ETFMG. Now, ETFMG was supposed to be handling the day-to-day operations, and that's what they did. Now, NASDAQ bought out ISE in 2016, and when that happened, there was the beginnings of a rupture in the arrangement between ETFMG, NASDAQ, and Pure Funds. Arguments over, were they paying the bills on time? Were they remitting the profits from the fees that they were supposed to? And that relationship began to fray almost as soon as NASDAQ bought out ISE. By the end of that first year, ETFMG decided to seize the funds for themselves. They changed the indexes. They stopped remitting the profits to Pure Funds and NASDAQ and kept it for themselves and decided that the funds belonged to ETFMG. And the fact that ETFMG, as the advisor and the trustee, had a tremendous amount of day-to-day and regulatory control of the funds allowed them to do this. And NASDAQ, of course, sued, as did Pure Funds.
And, you know, I think one of the things that made this quite a newsworthy story, you mentioned HAC, when that launched back in, whatever it was, 2014, at that time, if you recall, 2012. Okay, Sony had that cybersecurity breach, and so it was like perfect timing. The publicity helped HAC raise, you know, what, $1 billion or so in that first year, and that's, you know, sort of the centerpiece of the ETFs in question here. Okay, so this suit was filed. Take us from there. What happened?
So NASDAQ basically sued, claiming breach of contract, and Andrew Chanin at Pure Funds had a kind of similar claims, a little bit different in a New Jersey courtroom, but it's the NASDAQ case we're talking about here. So NASDAQ sued for breach of contract in 2017, and this the case dragged on for quite some time. It featured, you know, testimony from NASDAQ executives, from ETFMG, from Pure Funds. And basically what happened is in December, a federal judge ruled against ETFMG and ordered ETFMG to pay $80 million in damages. And the judge was really harsh in his assessment of ETFMG's CEO and founder, Sam Masucci. He ruled that ETFMG blatantly breached its contracts, I'm quoting from the judge here, by appropriating these profits for itself. He also said of ETFMG's founders, and these are just some of the things the judge described the testimony, contrived and unpersuasive, threadbare and unconvincing, incredible and clearly false, demonstrably false, knowingly false, fictitious, overwhelmingly disproven by the evidence at trial. It was a pretty damning ruling, but the interesting thing about it was actually kind of a split decision, because under the 40 Act, the judge really didn't have any ability to step in and force ETFMG to revert the funds back to the control of either Pure Funds or NASDAQ, because the 40 Act gives the trustees, which includes ETFMG, control over the fund. And so the judge basically awarded damages in the amount of $80 million, like I said. And it seemed like NASDAQ also really wanted to retake control of the funds, so the two settled. And that settlement is in process now, and that's kind of where we are today. And the financial terms were not disclosed, but as part of the settlement, two of the disputed funds, as you mentioned, HAC and iPay, will be reorganized under exchange-traded concepts and will presumably you know, revert to those kind of profit sharing agreements between, you know, peer funds and NASDAQ that existed prior to ETFMG's intervention.
Yeah, and I think this is where it gets a little bit muddy. And I know this is the news you reported on last week. So as I understand it, there's a vote that will take place to determine whether or not HAC and IPAY move over to exchange-traded concepts. Do I have that right? And what does that process look like?
That is correct. You have that right. Now, like I said, the judge basically ruled in NASDAQ's favor, but it was a split decision because under the 40 Act, the judge couldn't grant control of the funds to NASDAQ or anybody else. Only the trust and the shareholders can do that. So this settlement, what's happening is the ETFMG board, the board that governs and, you know, is a kind of the independent monitor of the funds, is recommending that the shareholders in IPAY and HAC approve the transition of those ETFs, of the investment advisory agreement and of the trust, over to exchange-traded concepts. So that's part of this settlement. And what will happen is, in early August, early to mid-August, investors in HAC and IPAY should receive a piece of mail. It'll probably come from Broadridge, who's helping to manage the proxy and identifying the shareholders. And it should be pretty well labeled. So if you get something in the mail that says, you know, important proxy vote, if you're a shareholder in one of these funds, please look for that. So what has to happen under what's called a 40 Act majority is, even though this is recommended by the board, you have to get enough votes. And that can be really tricky for ETFs with a huge retail audience because you have to identify shareholders. And there are thousands, and some might hold only a handful of shares, and some might own hundreds. So you have to identify them, you have to contact them, and apathy is the biggest enemy here because most people take that investor mail and chuck it in the trash. Most people won't answer the call when the proxy solicitor calls because they'll think it's just another robo-dial that they don't want to deal with. But it's essentially what has to happen is either 51% of all shareholders must vote to approve it, and that's a nearly impossible threshold because it's really hard to get all shareholders together. The more likely scenario is what happens is more than 50% of shareholders must cast a vote, and that can be abstain, it can be, you know, a no vote, or it can be a yes vote, but more than 50% of shareholders must vote, and of that more than 50%, two-thirds need to vote to approve. Now, approval is not controversial here because the board is recommending it, and you might get 98% approval, but if you only have 49% of shareholders voting, it can't pass. So the hard part is getting people to actually cast their vote. And that's what the proxy solicitors will be working on. You know, once those solicitations go out in early to mid-August, then shareholders might be getting phone calls. They might be getting, you know, messages from their broker. Here's the good news is it's pretty convenient to vote. You'll be able to vote by mail, online, or by phone. So you'll be given a number. It's almost like if you recently got the mail from the census where you have like an individual identification number and you go online to the census website and you fill out everything. It's kind of like that. You'll get a piece of mail. You can either mail it back or you can go to the website or you can dial the number and you'll have like an identification number that's unique to you and you'll tell the proxy solicitor firm, here's, you know, I'm voting yes or no. So it's going to be pretty easy. The hard part is actually getting enough people to pay attention to the mail and actually vote.
Okay, so as you walk through that, that actually raises a couple of questions for me, and you may not know the answer to these, but if this is approved, does that formally end the dispute here? Is it done? And then I guess on the flip side, what happens if it's not approved?
Okay, so if it is approved, that should end this dispute. That should be the end of this dispute. There were five funds still in existence that were part of the dispute, and from what I understand, the other three funds are going to remain with ETFMG as they are now. That's my understanding. That could change. Those tickers are SILJ, that's a silver miners ETF. There's Gamer, GAMR, which is a video game tech ETF, and there is what was formerly iFly. It was a drone ETF, and it changed to IVES, which is now a global cloud technology ETF. Those funds should remain with ETFMG as part of the settlement, is my understanding. The other two funds would migrate over to exchange-traded concepts, and if approved, essentially it won't be a taxable event. That's the big news for investors. This is not a taxable event. The tickers will remain the same. The indexes will be similar. They'll actually revert to the indexes they used prior to ETFMG taking them over. Nothing should really change for investors even when it's approved. Your brokerage account will look the same. The fund names will be different, and that'll be it. The tickers will be the same for iPay and HAC. To answer your second question, what happens if it isn't approved? Well, fortunately, the SEC gives the proxy solicitor a lot of time. So right now, the quote-unquote shareholder meeting, which won't be in person and isn't normally in person, most people participate remotely anyway, even when there isn't a pandemic. But the shareholder meeting will probably be sometime in mid to late September. And the proxy solicitors will tally the votes every single day. You don't have to vote at the shareholder meeting. In fact, you can't. So people will be casting their votes every day as they receive these ballots. And the proxy solicitor will be tallying it every day to see, do we have, you know, a quorum? Do we have more than 50%? And do we have approval? And if it gets close to the meeting date and they're like, wow, we have 98% approval but only 48% of the vote, we need to get more ballots, they can just delay the meeting date. Now, you can't do this indefinitely. You couldn't do it for years. But they could delay it by 2 weeks. They could delay it by 2 months just to make sure that they actually get enough people to vote, which, like I said, is the harder part of that hurdle.
So ultimately, the expectation would be that these are likely to be approved. It just may take some time.
It just may take some time. It will take at least to sort of mid to late December, and if they need more time to gather more votes, they have the flexibility to take a little more time to get more investors to cast their ballots.
Briefly, I want to go back to something you were mentioning earlier in terms of potential investor impact, and I think it's important to point out that throughout this entire scenario going back several years, there really has been no impact to the end investor. These funds have traded, they've operated as normal, everything's gone smoothly, there's been no issues. But I just want to be clear, if these ETFs are reorganized under exchange-traded concepts, it sounds like there's really nothing investors should be concerned about in terms of the operations of the fund. You mentioned they're going to keep the same ticker. It looks like maybe they go to a different index, but the index is highly similar. I just want to make sure we have that, because the reason I wanted to talk about this topic today was really on that investor impact side.
Yeah, the biggest thing for investors to know is this is not going to be a taxable event. I think that's probably the biggest concern for investors is, will this, you know, trigger a taxable event? It will not. The second thing investors want to know is, does my investment objective change? No. The industries and the indexes are going to be, the industries will be the same. The investment objective of tracking an index in those industries will be the same. It'll be a slightly different index, but it will actually be the index that the funds tracked prior to ETFMG's takeover. An exchange-traded concepts is, you know, a capable firm. They already manage other funds, so there's no, you know, kind of indication that it's going to be problematic in any way.
Okay, about a minute left before I let you go. I know one other question that we've heard from investors is whether, you know, some of ETFMG's other ETFs might end up footing the bill for any of this. So let's say HAC and iPay move over to exchange-traded concepts. The question's been raised, will ETFMG maybe hike the fees on the remaining ETFs to sort of cover the lost revenue? Do you have any insight into that or how the settlement might otherwise impact ETFMG's business?
I don't have any insight into that. I know at one point during the legal dispute, ETFMG did tack on some additional fees to some of its ETFs to pay for its legal costs, and they were told not to do that and stopped. So I don't know if they could or would, even if they could, try to put the settlement costs on their other funds. I would think that their shareholders would be pretty ticked off if they did that. So I don't think it would be a good move. But that's just my opinion. I don't know what they would actually do. I don't know if they would or could do that. I don't have any insight into that, and it would be a question for them.
Well, Ajalan, really appreciate the time this week. A pretty wild story, I think, especially in the relatively boring ETF space. But appreciate your work covering this, and a pleasure connecting this week. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was ETF.com contributor Ajalan Loader. All right, my next guest is the incomparable Dave Nottig, Chief Investment Officer and Director of Research at ETF Trends and ETF Database. I call Dave the walking ETF encyclopedia, so he has actually never whiffed on any ETF question I've ever asked him. It's remarkable, and he's now joining me via phone. Dave, great having you back. How have you been?
I've been great, but I'm not sure I can live up to a setup like that.
we always have to have the best walk-up music anytime you're on the podcast. Dave, I have a bunch of ETF topics for us this week. And yeah. I actually thought we'd start where we left off last time you were on the podcast, which I believe was towards the end of March. And we were talking about the Fed's bond ETF purchase program. This hadn't been started at that time. But of course, since then, the Fed has been buying up bond ETFs to the tune of billions of dollars. And interestingly, we can actually see exactly what they're doing. They've been releasing this data on their purchases. I'll just start this week. Any thoughts on how this has gone so far? Any surprises, disappointments? Has this been handled correctly?
I'm feeling pretty good about it, honestly. I mean, we've got, in the report that they're publishing, they break it out quite nicely. We've got about $6.8 billion in purchases so far. I suspect they're slowing down a little bit, just sort of watching what's been going on in the corporate bond market. It wouldn't surprise me if, the month from sort of June 18th to July 18th, which is sort of the block they're working on, might be lower than that. I don't think they're going to just continue to buy indefinitely. I think the most interesting thing, though, is that they're not just telling you what positions they've got. They're telling you precisely what trades they've made. And all told, it's, 400 or 500 trades that they've actually executed. They tell you what day they've been executed, the number of shares, and the purchase price. And what's really interesting is with that data, you can then go run the tape and see for any given day when they showed up to be a big whale buying, how well did they do? And anecdotally, I've run through all their purchases on things like Deutsche's HYLB and some of the less well-known ones. LQD from iShares is going to be able to absorb all the volume in the world at the moment. But things like ANGL from VanEck and HYLB from Deutsche are a little bit different. And honestly, it looks like they're doing a very good job. Like most of the trades seem to be coming in below, VWAP. They're coming in often with price improvement over the existing market when the trade hits the tape. So far, so good. It's real hard to argue with.
I know there was initially some concern that because BlackRock was running this program, that it would be all iShares ETFs being bought, right? But that obviously hasn't been the case. You mentioned HYLB. Another ETF in there is Angel, right? The VanEck Vectors Fallen Angels High Yield Bond ETF. What has been your impression of the actual ETFs used?
I think they make a lot of sense. We should point out that, $3.3 billion of this did, in fact, go to iShares products. So it's not like they're spreading it out evenly across the industry. But they're also, four Spider funds that are in there, a couple of Vanguard funds. And then, like I said, one fund from VanEck and one fund from Deutsche. I think those two in particular may be a little bit of a nod to like trying to look as diverse as possible. ANGL, for its part, that is legitimately a unique strategy. There's not a direct competitor that's giving you that same portfolio with the kind of volume you'd need to be able to absorb it. So I feel like they haven't left a lot on the table. I don't feel like there are huge swaths of the industry that they're ignoring. It's a little bit of a who's who of the corporate bond space.
One of the things that I've seen out on Twitter in particular, if you look right now, the Fed's now a top five holder in most of the bond ETFs they've purchased. Still a small percentage in terms of ownership overall, but they have shot right up the leaderboard of owners. Does that concern you at all? Because I think the worry out there is what happens when the Fed ultimately sells.
Yeah, I understand that worry. I don't think the Fed's going to sell in my lifetime. That may be a bit of a hyperbole, but the idea that somehow the Fed is going to quickly unwind this strikes me as ludicrous, right? They're going to keep these things on the balance sheet for the foreseeable future. And it's going to take a strong, booming, recovering credit market and a strong, booming recovery of corporate America before they start unwinding these positions. So They've signaled that they're not only willing to do whatever it takes, they're willing to do it for as long as it takes. So I'm sort of unworried about that, because we're going to be in a very different world when these things unwind.
Before we move on, I think I asked you this last time, but I'll ask you again. What is the likelihood that the Fed purchases stock ETFs? Or I guess maybe a better way to frame the question, what's more likely, that they unwind their bond ETF purchases or actually start making stock ETF purchases?
I actually think it's more likely that they'd wade into the equity market than that they'd quickly unwind these. Now, you know, pundits will point out there is no legal framework under which the federal government in any of its guises can own the corporate, you know, stock of American companies. But that's true for corporate bonds, too. And they figured out a way to do that. So, you know, we're so far outside the Fed charter at this point. We effectively have a new central bank, which is the combination of the Fed and the Treasury together. So it just seems not necessarily inevitable. But should we, for instance, have a retest of the March lows because of, I don't know, who knows what's driving the markets these days? But another dramatic 20% run down, and there'll be pressure on the government to figure out a way to backstop that market too. And in fact, that's sort of what we're seeing indirectly, right? By putting this bid underneath all these corporate bonds, it has the effect of raising all asset price levels. And by keeping rates so low, that is in effect driving investor money into the equity market. So there's just no question the fiscal process of the United States is supporting asset prices. That's what we've decided we care about.
That actually brings up an interesting topic. I'm curious, do you have any strong views on the financial markets right now? And I know you're not the market call type, but are you able to sort of square the economic situation with the markets and then everything the government and Fed is doing? Does any of this make sense to you, or does it all make sense to you?
I can tell you a narrative about why the prices we see in the market right now exist. It's not one that I happen to believe very strongly. There are several components of it. One is the what else are you going to do argument. And I think there's some legit, that's a legit question, right? If you're an endowment or an institution that has a mandate to, you know, be invested, what are you going to put your money in? You're going to put them in 20-year treasuries and get nothing? Are you going to go to some other, you know, bond market and get even less? Or are you going to look to risk assets? And I think there's a lot of truth to that, right? Where else can all of this invested money go if not into the world's stock market? So I get that argument. That's really a sort of supply and demand argument for risk assets. But, you know, at the individual company level, it is really difficult to square the circle around things like earnings and dividends, et cetera. So I'm not a believer that we've passed all of the problems and now we're just going to be back to a, you know, 10% equity markets year after year. I actually think we're going to continue to see tremendous volatility this year. And I think it's sort of a 50-50 bet on whether we retest the March lows before the end of the year.
Well, and also, you know, That assumes that we don't get a second COVID wave, a severe COVID wave. Obviously, we have the election upcoming. So just those two things alone, you have a lot of uncertainty on the table. But I think you're right. I think for investors, trying to handicap risk and return right now is really difficult. And I know there's a lot of talk around the Fed, quote unquote, distorting the market. But, you know, how do you properly evaluate risk return?
Well, and to be blunt, we're so focused on these hyperbolic headlines around COVID, as we should be, around these unprecedented fiscal stimuli, as we should be, around the economic collapse we've seen around the world, as we should be, that we're not paying attention to several other very large things going on, like the fact that we have two carrier groups in the South China Sea, which in any other environment would be the most dramatic political thing that's happened in a decade. The dissolution of Hong Kong, effectively, what's been going on in the Middle East. We're just not even paying attention to those things from a market's perspective because the other stuff is still so loud. So even if we could solve all these other big problems, we still have major geopolitical risks.
That's a great point. And also something else simmering in the background, and really, I guess it's not in the background anymore, is the civil unrest, which you and I actually talked about like a year and a half ago as being something that was a concern. So you have that on the table as well. Okay, let's move on, because I have to ask you about a topic that I actually blogged about last week, and I'm not sure many people appreciated my take, but I'd love to get your thoughts. So Barstool's Dave Portnoy and Robinhood traders, and all of this media buzz surrounding both of them. And I guess there are probably several different directions we can head here, but I'll first ask you, do you view Portnoy and Robinhood as good or bad for investors, especially younger investors?
You know, there are two sides of the story. So do I think that David Portnoy is the person that we should all be listening to invest our retirement money? No, of course not. Entertainment trading, which I think Dan Egan from Betterment may have coined that term. If he didn't, I apologize to whoever I stole it from. You know, entertainment trading and entertainment investing is nothing new. However, it is something that we tend to associate with frothy markets and tops, right? We saw this in the rise of day traders in the late 90s. We all know how that ended. So I do think that there is just sort of an entertainment component to it. Now, the good part of that is that if this exposes a whole generation to the idea of investing, that's generally a good thing, right? In order to open your Robinhood account and follow Portnoy and start picking companies, even if you're doing it badly and you're losing money, there's a level of investor education that had to happen just to get that far. So in that sense, I think anything that brings a new generation to focus on investing is a good thing. My hope is they tire quickly of the sort of entertainment trading component of it and discover investing as a powerful tool towards building wealth, and taking care of a family and achieving your goals. So I think there is a good component to it, but, you know, short term, I think mostly it's noise. Obviously, we all know Robinhood as a platform is infinitesimally small. It's not like they're driving the market. But I do think it's the case. We've seen an uptick in retail attention. And so we're seeing a little bit of that sort of frothiness that I tend to associate with tops.
No, I think all of that's well said. And going back to whether Robinhood and Portnoy are good for younger investors, I tend to land that I do think it's good, because it can be really hard to get younger people interested in investing. And if this is a way to get somebody interested, to go be exposed to the markets and in ETFs, and I realize that not all of them are taking this as a learning opportunity, right? Some are definitely just gambling. I get that. But but in general, I think if we can get younger people interested here, I think to the point you were alluding to, I think naturally over time, they'll probably evolve to a better investing style. I mean, if you're gambling and getting beat up, which at some point everybody does, isn't the natural evolution to move to diversified funds and maybe even indexing at some point down the line? So I think that's good. Now, on the other hand, one thing that I go back and forth with, I saw a tweet. So it was from a guy named AJ Warner, and I want to read this to you. He said, quote, "I recently moved funds from Robinhood to Schwab, and it's unbelievable how much less I'm checking. The addictive nature of the design is remarkable." And of course, he was referring to the addictive nature of the Robinhood platform.
Oh.
And I think this guy has like 150 followers or something, but this tweet got a lot of traction. And so I think clearly it resonated. Do you think there's something to that? You know, a lot of people have talked about how Robinhood has gamified investing. I do think that's a legitimate behavioral concern.
Oh, 100%. Like, you know, I have a Robinhood account largely just to sort of, you know, be part of the conversation and make sure I know how everything's working. But it is an incredibly well-designed app, right? It is a Skinner box, right? It is a behavioral masterpiece, right? It is, you know, it is Tinder for investing. Swipe up to trade. You know, it's presenting you with ideas based on what your friends are doing. So you have FOMO about every single thing you see on the screen. It is brilliantly designed to generate trades. That is probably not a good thing for most people. Most investors are better trading much less than they do. So you could say that's not necessarily a societal good. But boy, the guys who designed that thing are very good at what they do.
All right. One other area on this topic, I want to talk about payment for order flow. So you wrote a nice piece on this. And there's a narrative that Robinhood traders are somehow getting ripped off, that the free commissions they're getting just mask the bad trade execution on the back end. But you actually wrote how this isn't that big of a deal, that it's really a non-story. Do you want to just briefly explain why that is?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the most important thing investors need to realize is when you stick your order into the market, you're protected by what's called the National Market System, Reg NMS. And one of the things that you're protected by is this obligation that your trade can't be put outside the National Best Bid Offer, the NBBO. And so when you look on screen, you see something is trading, you know, 100 by 101, and that's the spread, is that dollar in between, and you put in, you know, a market order, like, you actually are not allowed to get executed outside that. It's actually a violation. So, and if you're doing the smart thing and using limit orders, then you're protected by your limit order as well. So the order flow payment, when Robinhood then just sort of shovels your order off to Citadel and Citadel pays fractions of a penny back to Robinhood for the privilege of executing that trade for you, the only way that you as an investor lose, with big air quotes around it, is if with another broker, you might have gotten price improvement. What's price improvement? Price improvement's when it's bid 100 by 101 and you get 100 and a half, right? So you get that half a dollar, you know, improvement. In reality, it's generally a half a penny improvement because most of the things we're talking about are trading a few pennies wide most of the time, right? So you're talking about these infinitesimally small potential improvements that, say, if you traded at Schwab, you might have gotten, that maybe you're not getting at Robinhood. There's a lot of maybes in that. And in the end of the day, we are talking about at very small fractions of your trade value. Would you rather have, you know, that dollar on a $1,000 trade in your pocket? Sure. But then again, you're also getting commission-free trading and you're getting this sort of app experience. That's worth something to you as an investor as well. So I don't feel like there is any giant ripoff going on here. It's not like there's a hidden 1% fee that nobody knows about. We are literally talking about fractions of basis points in most of the cases, right? Mills, if you will. And for most investors, that's just an irrelevant amount of money.
Yeah, and it only can even become relevant, to your point, if you have a large sum and you are constantly day trading, right?
Where maybe
that can add up over time. Okay, let's go
for
back.
For anybody who's actually investing, this is irrelevant.
That's right. All right, let's go back to ETFs. I want to read another tweet. This is one that you sent out last week. You said, I know we're all focused on day trade darlings, but the ETF industry pulled in $58 billion in June and $202 billion year to date, largely in the low-cost beta. You said VOO, the Vanguard S&P 500 ETF, that alone pulled in $22 billion year to date. And so you said, while the other stuff is more fun to talk about, the cheap passive revolution rolls along. And sort of the funny thing here is I actually want to ask you about some of the fun stuff this week. We can do that in a minute. But I want you to comment on the cheap beta first. How impressive is what ETFs are doing this year?
Yeah, I think it's enormormously impressive, right? I mean, $200 billion in any year for a six-month window would be, you know, close to all-time highs. You know, I think our all-time highs were 2017. We had about $450 billion, something off the top of my head. I think it's not inconceivable to think this could be a $500 billion a year in terms of flows, a couple more market events, people put money back to work. I think it's absolutely within sight. And for the most part, that is going into perfectly good product, right? $22.5 billion into VOO, $16 or $17 billion into LQD, a bunch of money into GLD. Okay, maybe that could have gone into a cheaper fund. But like these are big, boring funds for the most part that are perfectly appropriate for most investors. So I think ETFs are doing the good, hard work here. You know, it's not 100%, right? I mean, one of the biggest winners this year has been USO in terms of net flows. And we all know the sort of issues that USO had with having to rebuild its index and position limits, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not 100% rosy. But when I look at the flows, the thing that I find most interesting actually is like this really has been the year for ESG. And that story I don't think is getting quite the coverage people would expect. I mean, it was not very long ago people were sort of clucking their tongues and saying, oh, there'll never be flows into ESG. It's, you know, under 1% of equity flows. It's like 25% equity flows this year has been into ESG products. We had, you know, close to $16 billion already this year. That's a big number.
Do you have any sense as to how much of those flows is organic versus bring your own assets, you know, BlackRock pumping a bunch of money into ESG ETFs and model portfolios or whatever, or does that not even matter?
I don't think it matters. I mean, it is definitely the case that there's some institutional money flying around here. But, you know, you look at the big winner this year so far, which I think is ESGU, which is iShares MSCI USA Fund. That's not like that fund didn't launch this year. That fund's been around for several years and it's had $5.5 billion in flows. Obviously, some of that $5.5 billion is big institutions. That's not mom and pops putting $100 in at a time. But what that does is it validates the strategy for advisors. It puts things on the leaderboard. So when investors are looking, they see these products. And it doesn't hurt that, you know, because of the energy avoidance most of these types of products have, most of them have outperformed, right? So it is really, I think, a seminal phase shift year for ESG investing. And I expect that we'll continue to see the flows.
What about thematic ETFs? You know, we were talking Robinhood traders earlier, and if you look, thematic ETFs are pretty popular there. So JETS has been a big one this year, BOTS, the robotics ETF, MJ, the marijuana ETF, and actually here in a bit, I'm going to spotlight another ETF that's been gaining quite a bit of traction there, BETS, the sports betting ETF. But I feel like thematic ETFs are definitely getting a lot more attention this year. Do you agree there's been an uptick in interest?
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely an uptick in interest. We haven't seen huge flows into these types of products. Like most of the flows are still, you know, what I would call basic asset class flows. But we've seen a lot of investor interest, and some of these funds have done really, really well. And I think that there are a couple things going on at once. One is, yeah, there's this rise of entertainment trading, and thematic funds are much like single stocks in that they have great stories and that makes them interesting to talk about. They makes them fun to watch, right? That I understand. But the flip side is, I think there is a genuinely valid question a lot of investors are asking, which is, what is actually going to be different when we come out of this? And the answer is stuff. Lots of stuff is going to be different when we come out of this. We're not just going to slide back into like 2021 and the economy goes back to exactly what it was like. I think it's reasonable to think things like travel and energy and entertainment, you know, live entertainment. These are things that are going to be troubled. I think there's going to be continued industrial slowdown throughout the world. I think there will be differences. And so funds like, say, Work From Home, the Direction Fund that just launched, clearly a thematic ETF, all of the funds from ARK Invest, all right, these funds are capturing people's imagination about what the new world is going to look like as we come out of that. BETS is the same thing, right? BETS is a fund that is saying, hey, you know, Work From Home is on one side, Play From Home is on the other. And BETS and NERD, the two funds from Roundhill, I think are great examples of thematic ETFs that tap into a genuine investor belief that the world is going to be different.
Well, and I think along with that, if you're an investor and you have concerns about where you're going to get returns moving forward, we were talking about bonds earlier, but I think that could certainly apply to just the broad stock market. I think some investors are looking at thematics as a way to potentially, you know, quote unquote, juice returns a little bit and get something that you may have outsized growth compared to an S&P 500 index fund. Dave, just a couple minutes left. I have to ask you about dimensional funds, DFA, entering ETFs. I thought this was a pretty big deal, but I'm curious, what was your take?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it feels a little bit like capitulation. You know, they're about 10 years too late to move the needle here. You know, I think their approach has now been mirrored by several other firms that have managed to garner some decent assets. So I think they're very late to the party. I think the biggest impact is on the financial advisor market, because there is a whole raft of folks, as you know, Nate, that have signed up to the DFA pledge, if you will. They've done the training to get access to the product line, the mutual fund product line. And all of a sudden, that cachet of having this exclusive access to this particular product suite, I think this is sort of the nail in the coffin. I think that was a great business model for DFA, and frankly, a great business model for a lot of advisors for many, many years. And I think we now have to acknowledge that has sailed, with the caveat that DFA isn't launching 100 ETFs. They're launching a handful of sort of their more popular strategies. And there's still another couple dozen in the DFA mutual fund world that aren't going to be in these sort of easily available ETF strategies. I'm curious to see whether or not assets flow. I'm actually quite skeptical that they're going to somehow magically become a billion-dollar player very quickly.
What do you think was the catalyst here for DFA? I know they referenced the ETF rule and the ability to use custom baskets. I wonder how much the early success of Avantis played in this decision. Do you have any thoughts just on what the driver was?
Yeah, I mean, without naming names, that was exactly what I was pointing to, right? Avantis basically took a bunch of folks from DFA, replicated the model, and crushed it, right? They've done very, very well pulling in assets. And so I think at this point they had no choice, right? At some point there are no barriers left. There are no reasons to say no. And I actually think they didn't have a choice. If they want to survive, they're going to have to do this. And I think we're going to see this throughout the market. I mean, T. Rowe announced a couple of days ago that, you know, they're getting into the space. They've got their final approvals on their active non-transparent structure. They're bringing to market their flagship products. I mean, you know, portfolio managers who've been crushing it since 1993, right? So they're putting it all on the table here. I don't think these types of firms really have much choice.
Well, that raises an excellent question. So if you look at the DFA ETFs, those are going to be transparent active. But, you know, we've had several non-transparent ETFs come to market this year, right? American Century, Legg Mason, Fidelity. You mentioned T. Rowe Price is set to launch here fairly shortly. And then if you look at the list of top performing ETFs this year, guess what? Actively managed. ARK Invest is all over that list. I know we always joke about it. I think you and I have talked about this for a couple of years, but do you think active ETFs may have finally arrived?
Well, they definitely have pulled in some flows. Again, like, as you point out, with, you know, pretty flagship funds there from Cathie Wood. But, you know, active as a class has pulled in about $19 billion so far this year. Now, a ton of that is in bonds, right? I mean, I think JPST, the ultra short-term fixed income fund from JP Morgan, is like $3 billion of that, right? So, yeah, there's these big traditional fixed income products that were very early to the active space. But, you know, you go down this list and there's quite a bit of other product there that's pulling in $100 million here and $100 million there. I mean, you know, we talked about Avantis a little bit, right? Those are technically actively managed equity products. And, you know, $100 million here, $200 million there, $300 million there, right? Those are real flows into funds that are a whole lot less sexy than what ARK is doing. I think there is, while I don't, I'm not a big believer that these active strategies as a class are going to outperform, because math would suggest that's not the case. It's definitely the case that investors and advisors are willing to take the shot now.
What is the path to success for active? Because I saw some data last week that wasn't great. You know, common refrain from active managers has been, well, we'll protect you in a downturn. Just wait until that happens,
yep.
Right? And then we had this big down move, and you look at the data, the majority of active managers still underperformed.
Still underperformed.
Right, so what is the recipe for success moving forward, or is there even one?
I think opportunities like, there are opportunities at times like now because of the volatility, not because I believe that volatility means active will outperform, but because volatility makes it easier to sell active, because the indexes look very volatile, because they are. So I think there are opportunities for marketing in these kinds of environments, with the enormous caveat that most active strategies are going to underperform. Not all of them, but picking them in advance is often really tough. And you also generally have to have a pretty long time horizon for any edge in the market to play out. So I'm excited to see these folks coming to play. It further entrenches the ETF structure as the structure of choice, which, whatever your belief system is about the markets. Honestly, may the best man win.
Well, Dave, excellent stuff as always. You kept your streak intact. There's still not a question that I've been able to stump you on. Really enjoy these conversations, and I always appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Dave Noddick, Chief Investment Officer and Director of Research at ETF Trends and ETF Database. I'm now joined by Will Hershey, co-founder and CEO of Roundhill Investments, who last month they launched the Roundhill Sports Betting and iGaming ETF, ticker symbol BETZ, B-E-T-Z. They also offer an eSports and digital entertainment ETF, ticker NERD, which I love. And they recently added another ETF under their umbrella, the Roundhill Acquires Deep Value ETF, ticker DEEP. And I now have Will on the line with me from New York. Will, great having you back on the show, and congratulations on the new ETFs.
Yeah, thanks so much, Nate. Glad to be here.
All right, so we have to start with BETS because I think this is a great story. You launched this in early June. Last I checked, this already has about 90 million in assets. And I have to throw out the stat, 20,000 Robinhood users own this as well. Are you surprised by the success so far? I know you wouldn't have launched this if you didn't think it would do well, but did you expect this kind of reception?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a bit, and we are a bit surprised at the rate of the growth, how quickly we got to, let's call it 90 million in AUM right about now. But not the amount. We believed in the sector. We believed in the product that it could grow over time. But to give you a little bit more color, we had 125 creation units in a single day at 25,000 shares per unit. We had $50 million come into this fund in one day, which is kind of, in my mind, up there with what you're seeing SPY take in a given day. We actually, as a result of how much interest we had out the gate, we called for a special rebound for our index because we hadn't contemplated having that much volume in a single day. So we're definitely surprised with the rate of the growth, maybe not the amount, but just how quickly it came in. And you mentioned the number of holders on Robinhood. I think we saw with our ETF, the fund go as viral as an ETF can go. There were TikTok videos made about the ETF. You know, people were talking about it on Twitter, on social media. So the speed with which everything happened is kind of represents the world that we live in nowadays, but not the amount.
All right. I don't want to get sidetracked here right off the bat, but I just can't help myself. When we talk about Robinhood, my sense from following you on Twitter is that you're a bit, I'll say, fatigued of FinTwit and other people sort of maligning the Robinhood crowd. Am I reading that right?
Absolutely. And I think the whole narrative of Robinhood traders kind of impacting the market and moving up airline stocks, I think that's overplayed as well. I think when you look at the amounts that a lot of these people are investing, it's definitely overplayed. But I think we've got to embrace what's going on right now with young people entering the market. I mean, look at how most people generate wealth over the course of their lives. Most people are generating that wealth by investing capital and earning return on that capital. It's good that young people are getting involved.
Do you have the same sentiment with Dave Portnoy? I was visiting with ETF Trends' Dave Noddick earlier and asked him a similar question. I mean, any thoughts on Dave Portnoy and what he's doing?
I it's in the same vein. I love what Dave Portnoy is doing. I also think Barstool and the way they've built that media brand is pretty impressive. I mean, he is getting the amount. His job is media, right? So he's earning a huge share of the financial media right now. And his focus is traditionally sports. I think that speaks to him and his brand and his company's brand. But at a higher level, I mean, you have, for those who maybe aren't familiar, you have Dave Portnoy on film pulling out Scrabble letters out of a bag and buying this ticker based on that. I don't know if I love that, but I think he's figured out at the core, you know, everyone when they're investing are going to make mistakes, they're going to learn. I think at the end of the day, he's bringing a lot of younger people into the market. You know, you see analogies, or at least I like to make the analogy that right now it's you know, Reddit message boards and Robinhood. Back when I was learning, it was Yahoo message boards and Scottrade. It's the same thing. History is repeating. It's rhyming. It's a very good thing that new people are getting into the market. It's maybe not so good, the types of, you know, risks that they're taking, but that's how people will learn, and young people will bounce back from it and, you know, build their wealth over time.
By the way, not that you need business advice, especially for me, but I feel like Dave Portnoy would be the absolute perfect spokesperson for your BETS ETF, right? No testimonials. He just needs to go out and wear BETS t-shirts and hats and stuff like that while he's doing his pizza reviews or even, you know, live streaming his stock picks. I think that'd be fantastic. Okay, Will, so where did the idea for the BETS ETF come from?
Yeah, so we started working on this idea kind of in the beginning part of the year. Really, what we're always going to be looking for with new product launches is what we believe to be secular long-term growth trends. And taking a step back, these are going to be thematic equity ETFs or sector-specific, however you like to call them, and really finding areas where we believe we can put differentiated products into the market. We don't want to be me too in terms of product, and sports betting and iGaming really fit that mold. Then we had DraftKings, the announcement that DraftKings was going to be taken public via SPAC acquisition in January, and that kind of gave us the momentum to say, hey, look, I think we're really onto something here. And just sharing another anecdote with you, in March, when every sport was kind of getting shut down, was right when we were presenting this idea to our trust board, and it was like, hey, do you guys really want to go through with this? And we said, look, we believe that sports are going to come back. There's also the online casino component. Let's push forward. And I think the timing ended up being pretty fortuitous, launching at the beginning of last month.
So let's talk about what the CTF actually owns. You mentioned DraftKings. I know that's in there. Penn National Gaming, other top holdings, GAN, Kindred. How is the CTF put together?
Sure. So for bets, we're kind of taking a similar approach to what we've taken with NERD. And really, our core belief is that thematic products are best suited when they're not market cap weighted, but instead really trying to get you that pure play exposure focus on assigning higher weights to companies that are more exposed to the theme. At the highest level, we're going after companies involved in regulated sports betting. That includes both offline, kind of brick and mortar, which we believe in less so long term, and more online, as well as iGaming, which is kind of this umbrella term for online casino. So that's poker, that's blackjack, that's slots being played online. And really, the companies fall into five main categories. You've got the companies operating the sports books themselves. You've got the B2B technology providers, lead generation. So these are kind of marketing, kind of play the marketing role in the grand scheme of things. Then you have the brick and mortar casinos who are moving into online. You mentioned Penn National is a great example, supposedly launching their Barstool sports betting app in September. We'll see how that goes. And then finally, these iGaming companies who are really more focused on the online casino, which is higher margin part of this whole industry.
Out of curiosity, I know there was some chatter about a sports betting ETF over the past, year or two. And one of the pushbacks to an ETF being launched was that maybe the overall universe was a bit too small, sort of limited, at least compared to some other areas of the market. I'm just curious, did you consider going active management here just to give you some additional flexibility because maybe the space is a bit smaller?
Sure, we did consider it, and we're always going to consider it as we go into new areas. But I think at the end of the day, really, we don't want to become stock pickers. And I think when you go active, there's always that temptation. Having worked at a hedge fund before, there's always the temptation to tweak things and make moves and make decisions. And really, we're believers in kind of long-term investing approach, and especially in this industry where we're kind of very early in things, especially in the U.S. Other markets are much more so developed, like Australia and the U.K. We're really unsure who the winners are going to be. So from that perspective, we really want to provide the tools for investors to get broad-based exposure to the sector. We are starting to see more and more companies come public. We mentioned DraftKings. There's another SPAC that's in the works right now. But there are enough companies. It just so happens that maybe compared to other ETFs, a lot of them are actually outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
So I think we're not going to claim to be the foremost experts in any sector we put out an ETF in, although we'd like to believe we've done our homework, and really let investors make their kind of single security decisions on their own.
And how many holdings again? Is it like 35 to 40?
It's right around 35 right now.
Okay.
Exactly.
And my expectation would be, as the space evolved, the ETF would become even more pure play, right? As you have new entrants into the market and more companies sort of gravitate to the sector. And I guess on that note, in terms of the overall investment case, my sense is most people probably agree this is going to be a pretty big growth area, because I think we can all see sports betting legalization on state ballots. That's easy to see. It continues to gain popularity in states where it's already been legalized. To your point earlier, it is growing in other countries. But I guess I would say that doesn't necessarily make this a good investment, right? Because you could argue everyone already knows that. And then we also do still have this backdrop of COVID-19. So I think that is a concern, just getting people in the door here. What is the longer term investment case, if you were to boil it down?
Yeah, and actually I'll just start with COVID-19, which obviously, as we all know, has postponed the sports we all love and want back on TV, and we're going to get some this month, which is awesome. So that's been a negative. But I think the positive of COVID-19 as it relates to this sector is you have budget deficits that have gotten significantly larger due to lost tax revenue. I think that's going to bring forward the regulation that you mentioned, but that's more of catalyst-driven. I think the longer-term investment case here is really a shift from physical to digital, and it's something we're seeing in every part of the economy. Part of the reason why we focused on esports and video gaming for our first ETF is this is something we really believe in. And you're looking at what in betting and gambling as a whole is the largest form of entertainment globally, $500 billion in gross gaming revenues. Only 10% of that is actually taking place online right now. Part of that is due to regulation. Part of that is just due to kind of demographic changes. So really, when we look at the long-term play, it's a shift from physical brick and mortar going in to place your bet on your favorite sports team to that taking place online. We also mentioned iGaming, which is this online casino that really is a higher margin opportunity. And just to put some numbers on the betting side of things, Morgan Stanley just came out with a great report earlier this month. They expect U.S. betting revenues from $250 million in 2017 to grow to $8.5 billion in 2025. And most importantly for investors, these businesses can get up to 20-25% EBITDA margins. So they're profitable long-term enterprises. This isn't one of those stories where, you know, it's just keep growing top line forever and try and get bought by someone else. These are potentially very profitable businesses at maturity. We just don't know who the winner is going to be yet, especially in the U.S. market.
Which is a good reason to play this via an ETF versus making individual stock selections. Will, just a couple minutes left. I do want to make sure to touch on your other two ETFs. You mentioned the esports and digital entertainment ETF, ticker symbol NERD. This just hit its one-year anniversary in June, right?
It did. It's been performing very well this year, up about 40% year-to-date coming into today. And I think this is another example of a long-term trend. You know, younger generations are spending more time playing video games, watching esports. But it also happens to be a sector that very much so benefited from shelter-in-place, stay-at-home orders. We saw record levels of games being played and watched in the second quarter. We just came out with a crazy statistic, which is Twitch, which is the most popular game streaming, for people to watch other people play, just hit over 5 billion hours watched in the second quarter. That was up 80% year over year. And I think that's kind of a decent proxy for leading into expectations for the overall industry in terms of earnings for this quarter. It's a very unusual sector in that earnings are projected and likely going to be very, very strong as long as we kind of have the shelter in place. We've also started to see some companies focused on the gaming hardware side of things really start to take off. And now we're starting to see some of the game streaming platforms break out as well.
Are there any big upcoming game releases?
We've had one that started to roll out, which is Valorant. That's from Riot Games, which is wholly owned by Tencent. And the big one everyone's talking about is Cyberpunk 2077. It's not an esport per se. It's kind of more of a role-playing game like a Grand Theft Auto. But that's the one that everyone's been talking about. I will say it has been pushed back its release date two times. So work from home, stay at home is great for actually games once they're into the market. But in terms of developing games, it's had a little bit of a negative impact there.
It is amazing. I mean, you look at this entire space, video games in esports, it's been on fire this year. I mean, clearly one of the best performing segments of the market. And I think to your point, people being stuck at home looking for something to do. There have been no quote unquote real sports, right, to watch, those sorts of things. So it's really been a nice, you know, mixture of catalysts that I think have driven this entire space. Will, I also want to ask you about an ETF that you recently partnered with Acquirers Funds on, the Roundhill Acquirers Deep Value ETF, ticker DEEP. And I know Toby Carlyle is behind that ETF. I actually had him on the podcast last year. He was tremendous. But what was the thought process here? Because you have two thematic ETFs in NERD and now BETS. What was the thought process on partnering with Toby on this Deep Value ETF?
Sure. So you allude to it. Our broader strategy is going to be focused on building thematic ETFs that are really going after long-term growth stories, potentially that appeal to a younger investor demographic. Deep certainly is a little bit different. Really, it was just that we were being opportunistic. This kind of opportunity presented itself. We said we have the ability to work with Toby on this. It's kind of a no-brainer. He's written tons of work on deep value investing and to work with him. And I think more than that, really, we want to have a full suite of products. So our esports and sports betting, I think you could probably categorize as more growth-oriented investments. And values had, you know, call it 10-plus years of underperformance. I personally believe that at the end of the day, companies will be valued on cash flows and earnings and the strength of their balance sheets. It seems like we're getting into value in an opportune time. So I think time will tell there. But this is kind of a little bit different than our core strategy. So for future rollouts, expect us to do more of the kind of thematic type products.
Value has to turn at some point, doesn't it? I know we keep saying that. This can't go on forever. Well, hey, great connecting. Again, congratulations on the success of a bet so far and certainly bringing Deep under your umbrella. And I look forward to chatting again soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Nate. Take care.
That was Will Hershey, co-founder and CEO of Roundhill Investments. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, love hearing from you. You can send me comments through etfprime.com, or you can just find me out on Twitter at Nate Geraci. Next week, I'll be joined by Spider ETF's Matt Bartolini. We're going to talk thematic and sector ETFs. And then Jeff Chang, co-founder and managing director at Cboevest, will discuss their defined outcome ETFs and their partnership with First Trust. Until then, have a great week, everyone.